Let's get started with the conflict in Gaza. Right now, there is a new article coming out in The Lancet, a high-ranked medical journal. They're talking about that the casualties, the people who have been killed in this conflict in Gaza, is the number is at least 186,000, and it would be 8% of the population in Gaza. And the other thing that was so amazing hearing that Haaretz reported that an Israeli newspaper reported that on October 7th, the Israeli army killed many Israelis in that battle between crossfire between Israel and Hamas. How do you see right now, considering these two information coming in considering what's going on in Gaza?
Oh, first of all, let me just start with with your questions. I start with the first one. As we discussed, the number of casualties and fatalities in Gaza, there have been several articles in the Western media saying that these are the figures that we have, namely something like 35,000 casualties. These are Hamas figures. So, let's be clear on that. First of all, these are not Hamas figures. These are Palestinian figures or the Ministry of Health figures. And the reason for that is that despite the fact that Hamas rules the show or runs the show on in Gaza, I mean before Israel, of course, the Ministry of Health depends on the Palestinian Authority, which is based in the West Bank. And the figures provided by the Ministry of Health are in fact endorsed by the Ministry of Health, and they are not they do not come from the Hamas command, but they come from this administration, which is a Palestinian administration. So I think it's important to say, because a lot of people have argued that these are Hamas figures and they are well above the reality and things like that. So these figures provided by the Ministry of Health are provided to the UN, and these basically are this is the figure that you see on the OCHA website that provides a daily update on the number of fatalities and casualties in Gaza, as well as the logistical situation and the nutrition situation in Gaza. So we can trust these figures. In addition to that, now you mentioned The Lancet. In fact, The Lancet has already provided a few articles on the casualties provided by the Ministry of Health of Palestine regarding the casualties in Gaza. And there are at least two articles that I have read, and they are mentioned in my book, the book which is, sorry, here behind me. And the figures I have in this book relate on that. And I mentioned this article on that confirms, because they checked the figures provided by the Palestinians with statistical calculations, and they confirmed that the figures provided by the Palestinians are conformed to the reality and based on the statistical figures we have from the Palestinian population in this area. So we can say that The Lancet provides a very interesting statistical and scientific, let's say, a check on the figures. Now, they have provided a new calculation, which is an estimate of the real figures of the casualties, because obviously, as we have mentioned on several occasions, there are many casualties that are still under the rubbles of the destroyed buildings, maybe in shelters or in the basement of these buildings, and so on and so forth. In addition to that, many fatalities have been vaporized, if you allow me the expression, by the use of extremely powerful bombs. I remind you that the Israeli have used those 2 tons bombs, of which the US has provided something like 14,000. So if you consider that, there are different figures or estimates regarding the number of Hamas fighters killed by the Israelis, but the Israelis even estimate that there are about 10,000 Hamas fighters killed, meaning that they use more than 1 2-ton bomb per Hamas fighters killed. So that shows the overkill that the Israeli use to destroy the Hamas fighters. And these 14,000 bombs, of course, they have they create fatalities beyond what is acceptable in a normal battle, if you want. And we can assume that a lot of civilians have been simply vaporized by these bombs. And I'm not even mentioning all other type of bombs that have been launched by the Israelis, and the artillery shelling, and so on and so forth. So we know that the figures that we see on the OCHA website every day, roughly 36,000 or something like that, this is well below the reality. Now, this is, and that's something which is very interesting. I mean, this article of Lancet, because to some extent, it confirms the allegation that the Israelis do more than waging a war against the Hamas. It's a little bit more than this. And these estimates tend to confirm the allegation of the attempt of extermination by the Israeli government of the Palestinian population. And that supports, or could support, the allegation of a plausible genocide that we have mentioned on several occasions, and that has been also mentioned by the International Court of Justice. So obviously, Israel use a firepower that is beyond necessary. And I remind you, I have mentioned that on your website, I think, a couple of times, but they are basically, in waging war, regardless of the type of war, regardless of the type of weapon, regardless of the situation, there are basically 3 principles that a fighting force should respect regarding the international humanitarian law, or the law of war, if you prefer. These 3 principles are: the first is the principle of discrimination. We should be able, I mean, any force before engaging a weapon should be able to discriminate between civilians and military objectives. And that's the basic rule. The second rule is the principle of proportionality, meaning that in order to destroy a military objective, you should use a proportionate force to the size and the type of objective. In other words, when we talk, when the example I mentioned before of the 14 tons, the 14,000 bomb, the 2 tons bomb used by Israel, And if we look at the results they obtained by killing something like 10,000 Hamas fighters, we see here, just by looking at these two figures, a clear disproportion of means. And again, the 14,000 is just a two-tons bomb. It doesn't include all other weapons that are being used by Israel. So meaning that we have clearly a disproportionate use of force to fight in this case, the Hamas. So this second principle is obviously not respected by Israel either. And finally, there's a third principle that is to be applied in war. This is the principle of precaution, meaning that if you are not sure about your objective, if you're not sure that you may destroy or kill civilians just by wanting to destroy a machine gun position or whatever, then you renounce using your weapon. And this is something I have mentioned in my book, because when considering a counterinsurgency, and if I assume that Israel is fighting a counterinsurgency war in Gaza, then you have a variety of strategies to address counterinsurgency that range from the mere political action to the military, the pure military action. And in between, you have a range of action that you can use through special forces, through targeted killing and things like that. I mean, the key words here is that you have a wide amount of strategies and tactical action that allow you to destroy, let's assume the word terrorists, that you can kill terrorists without harming the civilian population. Now, in Israel, they use the word terrorist as an excuse to destroy everything. And that's an abuse of the word terrorist. So that's why I think the use of word terrorism, and that applies to our countries as well, by the way, not just to Israel, but also to our countries. When we use the word terrorist, it's some kind of open door to any kind of strategy and type of weaponry that we can use. Because, of course, we don't like terrorists, and therefore, then when you define your objective as terrorists, everything is allowed. And that's why I'm totally opposed to the use of word terrorist, which is, by the way, has no official international recognized definition. So everybody can interpret its own definition of what is a terrorist, and therefore what kind of methods, strategies, and weapons you can use to destroy this terrorist. So I think using that word is the open door to abuse. And when Israel says that the West has done the same abuse before them, I think they are right. The West has abused this kind of wording, and not just in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, but also at home, because then it allows the disregarding the law. And we see that in countries like France, UK, and even the US, it has allowed to use a kind of a special legislation. And typically we have in the US what the US has done in Guantanamo, for instance, by redefining the word combatant or foreign combatant and all the kind of wording you have, that allows then any kind of abuse, including torture and all that. So I think it's a very unfortunate evolution in using this kind of wording, because we are back to what the Germans did during World War II in many countries by defining people as terrorists and then thus allowing any kind of punition and punishment against the local population and, of course, against the resistance. So we are back to square one with this kind of behavior, and that's why I'm very opposed to the use of the word terrorism. Now, coming back to Gaza, we see that Israel is using this word, and therefore everything is allowed. And interestingly enough, the international community, which is so keen to condemn any kind of alleged abuse in Ukraine by the Russians and all that, by the way, interestingly enough, they condemn the Russian abuse, but never the Ukrainian abuse. And we have now, for instance, recently, we have the Czech have arrested a guy who has been involved. I mean, it's a mercenary, a Czech mercenary, who used to work for the Ukrainians, and he participated to the massacres in Bucha. And Bucha was attributed to the Russians, but we know, and I have mentioned that in my books also, that despite the fact that we have no hard evidence to know exactly what happened, all indications show that this was a few massacres done by the Ukrainians. And now we have this guy who is currently in a court in the Czech Republic that shows that Ukrainians have done these massacres. And nobody is condemning that. So basically, we can say that Western countries, that includes France, Switzerland, Germany, and they are in fact approving massacres as long as they are done by non-Russian and non-Israeli. Yes, as long as they are not done by their enemies, they allow these massacres. So we are in a double standard kind of enforcement, or not even enforcement, but understanding of the international humanitarian law, which is extremely disturbing. And that applies to my country, Switzerland, which is a country that advocates, or officially at least, in the official discourse, say that they advocate the principles of humanitarian law and all that. And that's absolutely not what Switzerland has done regarding Ukraine, and not even Palestine. Not even in Palestine. So we see here a very dangerous change in the way we understand our values, or the values we pretend to defend. And that is extremely disturbing. So that's related to the number of casualties and fatalities, and this last article by The Lancet, which is quite interesting, because The Lancet is a scientific publication which is highly reputational, and I think nobody can argue against that, because it's not non-politically motivated. Now, coming to the second part of your question, which is this article that was published in Haaretz. Now, it's interesting to see that this particular article gained a lot of traction in the West in the last couple of days. But in reality, we had other articles that were published last year, in particular by Ediot Ahonot, and I mentioned these articles in my book, because just after the 7th of October, of course, Israelis wanted to know what really happened that day, and they wanted to have an explanation about all these casualties and all that. And remember that just after the 7th of October, the Israelis claimed that the Palestinians had killed 1,400 civilians. Now, just 3 weeks later, they had to remove 200 fatalities from that figure, because they noticed that the bodies that they found were so burned that they couldn't decide whether they were Palestinians or Israelis. But the thing is that to have a corpse burned to that degree means that some weaponry should have done these burns. And we know that the Palestinians had as an objective to take prisoners, and namely military prisoners from the so-called Gaza envelope. And they wanted to, so they didn't need to have heavy weaponry. They came with just light weapons, light Kalashnikov and things like this, but nothing of the sorts that can create so heavy damages and heavy burns as we have seen after the 7th of October. So what happened then? How come we found 200, at least 200, because if the Israeli could not discriminate, that means that they had other corpses that were equally burned. And that was not done by Palestinians. So that was done by Israelis. And in fact, Idiot Ahronot published a very interesting article. Now, I don't have the date in mind. You can find that in my book if you're interested, because I mentioned this article quite extensively, where they, in fact, they describe how the 7th of October unfolded. And they recreate the whole timeline of what happened on the 7th of October. And what they found out is that on the 7th of October, the Israeli military command was in total disarray, and that partly because getting out of Gaza, the Palestinians destroyed almost all the CCTV cameras that were monitoring the area, meaning that, and they destroyed also the communication between the observation towers and the headquarters of the Gaza division, which was responsible for the surveillance of the Gaza area. As a result, the Gaza division, which is responsible for monitoring the whole area, was totally blind. And as a result of this blindness, the Gaza division was not able to give precise orders to their units. By the way, many units were redeployed at this stage on that very day, were deployed in the West Bank because of the policy with the settlers. In policy, they had disturbance and unrest in the West Bank. Therefore, they had to redeploy units of the Gaza division to the West Bank. As a result, they had not enough troops in the Gaza envelope, and they didn't know how to direct these troops. When the Gaza division command asked the headquarters in Tel Aviv to provide more information based on aerial surveillance and things like this about what was going on in their area of operations, the headquarters in Tel Aviv was equally blind. And therefore, they gave orders to combat helicopter to go and see what was going on in the area. And that was a total mess in this area. And therefore, the command said, I make a long story short, but the command gave, in fact, the order to fire at anything. And they had, basically, those helicopters had a blank check to open fire on anything that could suggest a Palestinian force or units or groups and things like this. The problem is that by doing so, the pilots and Eduard Aronaut had the ability to listen to the dialogue between helicopters and the ground for the ground command and all that, and they noticed that the helicopter pilots had absolutely no idea about what was going on. They had absolutely no understanding of what was going on, and therefore they started to shoot all around to anything that was moving. And that's the reason why, in fact, and because of the very substantial firepower of the Apache helicopters, in fact, the Israelis themselves destroyed almost everything on the ground. And in my book, I published some screenshots of the what we can see from the video provided by the Israeli Defense Forces on that very day. And we see that the helicopters shot at normal vehicles that were heading towards in the general direction of Gaza, and then they destroyed the vehicles. We know that the Palestinians have entered the Gaza envelope with pickup type of trucks, because these are the trucks that where you can load many combatants. You can even put a machine gun on top, so it's a small personal carrier if you want. And we know that they had this kind of vehicles, but on the video provided by the Israeli Defense Forces, we see that the helicopters shot at normal small cars that you have in our cities. You know, very small cars, obviously cars used by young people and all that, and without knowing who was in the car, meaning that most probably, and when we see the people running around these cars, we see that most probably these cars had, in fact, a lot of these youngsters that were attending this rave party, and they were caught in the fire of the Apache helicopter. So it's not really a crossfire, as you said, it's simply a blunt fire from the helicopters. And why direct fire at helicopter from the helicopters. In fact, and that was confirmed by a colonel of the Israeli Air Force, that said that they have applied the so-called Hannibal directive, and he used the expression, "We have used a mass Hannibal on that day." So what is the Hannibal directive? In fact, this is a directive that used to be confidential, that is designed at preventing Palestinians to take prisoners or hostages. But the specificity of the directive is that to prevent the seizure of a prisoner, the priority is given to the destruction of the Palestinians, even at the cost of the life of the prisoner. So the priority is the destruction of the Palestinian and not thus saving the life of the prisoner. Meaning that if you see, for instance, a Palestinian taking a prisoner or a hostage, we have already discussed this kind of wording, but anyway, if you see a prisoner, then you shoot at what you see, regardless of whether or not you will shot your own Israeli soldier or a civilian. That is no matter. The important is that you destroy the Palestinian. That's the Hannibal directive. It's extremely ruthless. And it legitimates the the non-discrimination of civilians and military, because then you just shoot at everything you see, and too bad for the prisoner. So the purpose of that directive is to discourage any hostage taking or prisoner taking, because then the logic is that if you attempt to take a prisoner, then there will be no mercy, everybody will be shot, and period. And it's also, of course, for those who are taken as prisoner, this is also kind of a burden, because the poor guy who is taking as prisoner, he knows that he will be killed because the priority will be the death of the Palestinians around him. So this is an extremely ruthless directive, which has been used, and we have there mentioned mentions of this Hannibal directive since the very beginning. In fact, it was mentioned already on the 8th of October. So we know that this directive was used. This was confirmed on many occasions in the Israeli press. The only thing is that these mentions of this Hannibal directive was never reflected in the Western media. And in the Western media, we continued with this narrative of the Hamas killing after the Israeli has removed the 200 Palestinians. Then the narrative was that the Hamas has killed 1,200 civilians in on the 7th of October, which is wrong, by the way, because as we just said, a lot of those who have been killed that day were killed, in fact, by the Israelis themselves. But in addition to that, you have about half of this figure, which is about 600. I don't have the exact and last figure that was counted, but roughly 600 of these people killed on the 7th of October were in fact military personnel and people from the security forces. So these guys were not civilians, as we say in the Western media. So you have at most 600 civilians who have been killed during that day. But as we said, we just said, those people killed were not killed. And I think there's a minority of these people, of these civilians, who have been killed by the Palestinians. And the majority, and we don't know exactly the figures, because as the UN tried to make an inquiry on what really happened on the 7th of October, the Israeli authorities denied the access of the inspectors to the data and to the location of what happened, to make any kind of inspection or inquiry on what happened. Even the vehicles that were parked, because you know there was this rave party just close to the military base where the headquarters of the Gaza division was settled. And in this rave party, these young these youngsters had all their vehicles parked, and all these vehicles had been destroyed by the helicopters. And even as people wanted to look at the remnants of those vehicles in order to assess how they were destroyed, the Israeli government denied this and decided to bury all these vehicles in order to make any inspection impossible. So we see that the Israeli government is obviously perfectly aware of what really happened that day, and that the Palestinians have probably only a very limited responsibility on what happened that day. Even the movie, you know that some actions of the Palestinians were recorded on individual camera that were carried by the Palestinians themselves, and these short movies were assembled by the Israeli government and provided to all the Israeli embassies in the world in order to show the Western media what happened. But interestingly enough, journalists who have seen these media, and that was only selected journalists who had access to this movie. But on this movie, you don't see any individuals or civilian killed. You see Palestinian shooting, but you don't know, you don't see any civilian killed by the Palestinians. You don't see any murder performed by the Palestinians. You don't see any rapes performed by the Palestinians. And all the atrocities, including babies killed and all that, are obviously not on these videos, which were, as I said, assembled as a propaganda movie by the Israeli authorities. So we can assume that most of the narrative that has circulated in the West regarding these atrocities are simply wrong. There were certainly, the Palestinians have certainly a shot at individuals, reportedly, because that was asked to some Palestinians, and reportedly they said that what happened on several occasions is that youngsters that were in this the area of the rave party, as they saw the Palestinians, they tried to reach out to their weapons that they had in the trunk of their cars in order to shoot back at the Palestinians. And that's the reason why Palestinians shot at those civilians, because they were in fact taking the weapons, because as you know, in Israel, many of the young Israelis belong to the armed forces. Even if they are not in service, they still have the weapon with them, and even civilians can have. This was the new laws established by Ben-Gvir, if I'm not wrong, who decided that even civilians have the right to be armed, and therefore you had a lot of civilians, young civilians especially, who have a weapon, in fact, at home, not just at home, but with them, and they can carry weapon and all that. As a result, of course, as the Palestinians came, they had to shoot at individuals who were returning fire. So this happened definitely, and several civilians were probably killed in those crossfires. Then it was really crossfire when people were taken in between of two firing parties. But I remind you that the purpose of the Palestinian attack on the 7th of October was to take prisoners. And why to take prisoners? It was to force the Israeli authorities to come back to the table of negotiations for the release of the prisoners, that because until end of 2022, you had a negotiations mediated by Qatar in order to release the prisoners that are in Israeli prisons. And as you know, at that time you had about 5,000 Palestinians with a charge, we were charged and in prison. But besides this, you had about 1,500 individuals in prisons, but without any charge. And the idea was to find a possibility to release those guys. And that was the purpose of these negotiations. But at the end of 2022, the Israeli government decided to quit the negotiation. And in order to have this negotiation to resume, the Palestinians decided to go and take some military as prisoners in order to force the Israeli to come back to the negotiation table. That was the idea. And that's the reason why we have, and that was reported by several media in Israel, and notably by radio, on radio channel, but also on TV channels and on the other medias, that it was reported that the Israelis, as they came into these kibbutzim, where obviously they were no longer soldiers, because as I said before, many soldiers had been redeployed to this West Bank, and as a result, the Palestinians didn't find those the military's soldiers they wanted to take as prisoners. So they entered civilian houses, and they asked the inhabitants to call the security forces, and they decided to wait for the security forces with the inhabitants in order to have then people to take as prisoners. So we see that as opposed to the picture we have in the West, the Palestinians made every effort to take military or security forces, individuals as prisoners, and try to avoid to have civilians. Why did they take civilians? It's not exactly clear, but it appears, and I have studied some of the testimonies that were provided in the aftermath of the 8th of October, and apparently, according to some Israelis, as the Israeli forces came into the kibbutzim and started to shoot at the houses, even if, and that was also the testimony of a young tank commander, a Merkava tank commander, who was ordered to shoot at a house. And when she asked, she's a woman, she's a young woman, probably in the early 20s and so very young tank commander. And she asked before, are there any civilians in these houses? And people told him, don't worry, just shoot. And so she started to shoot at the houses. But in these houses, you had both civilians and Palestinians. And then people started to flee away from these houses. And the Palestinians, and that comes out of some testimonies that were provided by Israelis themselves, the Palestinians tried to protect those civilians against the fire of the Israeli army. And that's probably the reason why they took those prisoners, because they didn't want to have civilians. And that's also the reason why, as soon as the 8th of October, they offered the Israelis to release those civilians in order to avoid an intervention in on the Gaza Strip. And the Israeli authorities refused that. So we see that everything has been made to worsen the situation on the Israeli side. And that's when you see, and again, what I'm saying here is not something that I'm making up myself. This was recorded, and it was reflected in the Israeli media in October, already in October 2023. So we know that, and therefore we know perfectly that most of the people who have been killed on the 7th of October have been killed, in fact, by the Israeli forces. And that continued after that, because even if the Israeli government said that the main objective was the release of the hostages and the destruction of Hamas, We know today that they didn't achieve the objective of destroying Hamas. That was, in fact, confessed recently by the speaker of the spokesman of the Israeli Defense Forces, where he said, "We will not be able to destroy Hamas." So this objective was not achieved, but they didn't even achieve the release of the prisoners. And most of the prisoners that have been taken by the Palestinians, in fact, have been killed by the indiscriminate bombing by the Israelis since their intervention within the Gaza Strip. As a result, we know that Israelis, and that's in fact is the application of the Hannibal directive. So it's nothing really new with that. But the fact of the matter is that most of the prisoners or hostages that have been taken by the Palestinians have been killed by the Israelis themselves. And even it happened, you may remember last year, I don't remember the exact date, I think it was November last year, when you had three young Israelis, former, I mean, part of the, they were soldiers, in fact, and they managed to escape the Palestinians, and they tried to reach the Israeli lines, and they had, they made on a kind of fabrics or their shirts, I don't know, they wrote some words in Hebrew, and they shout in Hebrew in order to make sure that they get they didn't be confused with Palestinians, and they shot shouted that they were Israelis, and please don't shoot, please don't shoot. The Israeli soldiers that were facing them just shot them bluntly. So there is a ruthlessness from the Israeli forces, including towards the Israelis themselves, that is something that to me is totally inexplicable for a military soldier. That's something that I think no military in the West would do. To shoot at their own soldiers bluntly with no reason. I mean, we're talking when I was talking about these three young soldiers, they removed their shirts just to show that they were not wearing a bomb belt or something like that, or some explosives, in order to make sure, but they were killed nonetheless. So we see that the Israeli, they don't care about their own soldiers. Why would they care for the Palestinians? You know, and therefore all these allegations, or what the Israeli government deems as allegation regarding indiscriminate shooting and all that, everything shows that it is a standard operating procedure on the Israeli side. And that's extremely worrying, because when we were talking about the values that we defend and all that, and we are very prompt to condemn any kind of allegation of what the Russian may have done or might have done and all that, but when it comes to the Israelis, we tend to accept any kind of crime. And remember that only the South Africa and other countries from the global south joined South Africa in this procedure against the Israeli government regarding the possible genocide in Gaza. So we see that the West here has absolutely no values. The values that we pretend to defend is just a propaganda matter. We have absolutely no interest in those values whatsoever. By the way, as we I have mentioned before, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, nobody cares about those values. We bomb people indiscriminately in the Sahel region as well, and that's the reason why the Sahelian countries have expelled the French military from this region, because they don't pay any attention to the civilians. They just shoot around. They don't take care about, you know, we don't care. That's it. We have absolutely no value whatsoever. We pretend we do have, but in reality, we have none. We apply, or we claim we have value just when it comes to condemning the Palestinians or Israel or the Russians. But for the rest, we accept any kind of illegitimate action because it doesn't suit our narrative. So, you know, this is something which is, in my view, extremely disturbing. And again, we are back to something we have already discussed on many occasions on your channel, that all this kind of behavior and double standard, that's exactly what the Global South looks at and what they notice. And it doesn't speak for us whatsoever. And how can we trust the Western countries when they violate so blatantly the international law? So, in my view, both as citizen and as a military, I find that extremely disturbing. And I this is something I don't recognize the values I used to defend during the Cold War and all that. This is absolutely not the kind of values I had in mind when I was still in the military and all that. This is beyond what we were trained for and what we were believing in. This is absolutely not what we were we intended to do in my time. Today, it seems that we have absolutely no value whatsoever. So this is, again, I repeat myself, very disturbing.
Yeah. When you look at the attitude of Netanyahu and he's insisting to attack Hezbollah right now, we don't know if he's going to attack before going to the United States or after going there and talking with politicians in the United States. But if Israel attacks Hezbollah right now, without anything coming from the United States, any sort of help coming from the United States, is Israel capable of defeating Hezbollah and on the ground? And if Hezbollah attacks the air bases in the northern part of Israel, in the center of Israel, in the southern part of Israel, how do you see the dynamic of this type of attacks on the part of Israelis? And how capable is Hezbollah right now in your vision?
We can have a slight idea of what could happen, because in 2006, the Israelis attacked the southern Lebanon, and they had to face Hezbollah. They made huge amount of destructions, but in fact, they were defeated. They were defeated. And that's the reason why they had in Israel many inquiries, because of the misunderstanding of the actual strengths, or the underestimating the actual strengths of Hezbollah, and how come the Israeli intelligence and military intelligence notably had not been able to assess properly the strengths of Hezbollah and all that. Now, what we have seen since last October in Gaza is probably a small example of what we could see in southern Lebanon, because the Israelis are not capable to do other type of warfare. Their doctrine is based on disproportionate reaction. That's the purpose, because they think that they are surrounded by hostile countries, and in order to avoid to be attacked, they have to be deterrent. Deterrence is the key word. And deterrence for the Israelis is in fact ruthlessness, to bring more destructions that they may receive. And that's the rationale for disproportion. And again, this was defined as early as 1951 by the young Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan, who became the famous general, especially during the Six-Day War. defined this strategy of applying disproportionate force in order to discourage surrounding countries to attack Israel. And that's exactly what the Israelis did as they were in Lebanon in 1982. That's exactly what they did when they were in Lebanon in 2006. And that's most probably what they will do if they attack the Hezbollah or the southern part of Lebanon today, because that's what they know how to do. It's destruction. They're not able to reconstruct. It's destruction, period. That's what they have done in Gaza, and that's probably what they will do in there. But regardless of the amount of destruction that the Israeli brought in South Lebanon, they were defeated. They were defeated. And I have mentioned, I think, on your channel already, but I urge those who look at this show to look at the cover page of The Economist in 2006, after the Israeli withdrew from the Lebanon, and you have this cover that shows the destroyed landscape and a young fighter having the flag of the Hezbollah, if I'm not wrong. And the title of this front page is Nasrallah Wins the War. And so that means that despite the destruction, despite all the killings they have done, the Israelis were defeated. And again, that's why we have, and that's a reason why I have as a subtitle of my book, The Defeat of the Vanquisher, or The Vanquisher, because the victory does not depend on the amount of destruction you bring to your enemy. It brings also at the way you wage the war and the way you fight. And what we have seen so far since October, but in fact since years now around Israel, is that this kind of indiscriminate and disproportionate use of force, in fact, works against Israel in the long run. And now, if you look at the public opinion in the West, I'm not talking about the leadership, because the leadership in the West, US, in most European countries, is highly corrupt. And therefore, regardless of what they see, they will only support Israel. But if you look at what the people think of Israel, Israel has lost all of its credibility. And it has lost most of the support it used to have. And if you look at the US, it's also interesting to see that a lot of Democrats who used to be the most fervent supporters of Israel are now very suspicious about Israel and even do not support the policy of Israel. The youngsters do not support Israel anymore. And even the Jews in Europe and in the US do not support Israel anymore. They don't recognize themselves in Israel. They used to have, I mean, I remember in the 1960s and all that, you had this idea of Israel was only democracy in the Middle East, and was these a lot of people went to work in kibbutzim to participate in the construction of Israel and all that. I think this time is gone. Nobody accept that anymore. This image of Israel is gone. We have the picture of a country that use indiscriminately force, that doesn't make any effort to adapt its tactics, its combat techniques to a situation where you have a population or civilian-rich environment, and therefore they have lost all their credibility. And see that very recently, that was a couple of days ago, by the way, the Arab League, if I'm not wrong, I think it's the Arab League, decided to remove the Hezbollah from their list of terrorist movement. They used to have the Hezbollah on the list of terrorist movement after pressure, of course, from the United States and all that. And so they put Hezbollah on that list. But now they just removed it, which shows that the legitimacy of those who resist to Israel is gaining traction. And that is something that I would be, if I were Israeli, I would be extremely worried, not because of the change of designation, because, as I said, terrorist doesn't mean anything, basically. It has no official international accepted definition. But it shows that the rest of the world, and in this case, the Arab League, is no longer ready to accept the Western narrative and that. They will make their own judgment, and they will support those parties as they want and not as the West wants. And I think that's a very interesting evolution. And that shows that if anything would happen, if the situation would escalate in southern Lebanon, I wouldn't be surprised to see many countries of the region joining the Hezbollah in order to fight Israel. Because then Israel would be attacking a country, by the way. You know, it's not just attacking Hezbollah, it's also attacking a country. By the way, remember that the rationale for the Hezbollah and the rationale for the Hezbollah to exist, it's because Israel has not released all the territory it has occupied in the southern part of Lebanon. And that's the reason why Hezbollah is still in place. You may remember that in 1979, at the end of the civil war in Lebanon, there was also an agreement that was passed with all the warring parties in Lebanon in order to disband the armed groups in Lebanon. These were known as the Taif agreement. And in this Taif agreement, it was agreed, I mean, all the armed groups agreed to stop violence and deposit arms. But the Hezbollah maintained that their rationale is not to fight other factions, Lebanese factions, but to restore the sovereignty of Lebanon over all its territory. And as long as Israel still occupies portions of the Lebanese territory, the Hezbollah will not drop its weapons. And that's the rationale for the Hezbollah. So meaning that if Israel attacks South Lebanon, it will not only be attacking an organization that basically defends its illegally occupied territory, but Israel would also attack a sovereign country. And the Hezbollah being probably the most effective armed forces in Lebanon and probably in the whole Near East. This means that the Israel will have a very hard time fighting against Hezbollah. But we know already that some faction, Iraqi factions and all that, have already pledged to come and help Hezbollah would the Israelis attack Lebanon. So we may well have a wider implication of other countries, I mean, the bordering countries of Israel, if Israel attacks Lebanon. The problem for Israel is the following. They have engaged a war in Gaza, for which the Israeli forces were not very keen to engage. I mean, they were not very enthusiastic about entering Gaza. They knew that Gaza was organized for defense because tunnels and trenches and all that, this is a defensive organization, which is in fact what you may have if you expect an invasion from a foreign country. And that's exactly what Israelis done. And the military probably knew that. And for that reason, they were not so enthusiastic to enter Gaza. But the Israeli government decided to do it nevertheless and promised a lot of success and the eradication of Hamas and all that. They didn't achieve any of their objectives. They didn't achieve any of their, they didn't release the hostages. I mean, yes, they have released 4 hostages. By the way, this was also a strategic failure. It was a tactical success, but a strategic failure. It was a tactical success because obviously they managed to release those 4 hostages, or they were prisoners of war, because there were 3 of them were militaries and one was a member of the security forces. So these were prisoners of war. So these prisoners were released, and that's the success. But the price for it was to kill almost 300 civilians. That already shows that Israel is not even able to do a hostage rescue operation with just special forces, something very surgical in nature. So they are not able to do that. They have to bring with them distractions and to destroy civilians. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect is that this operation have demonstrated that the Israeli forces used to occupy the area where those prisoners were retained, meaning that during months, the Israeli forces were just a few meters from these prisoners without knowing they were there, meaning that their intelligence organization failed basically to know that. That's the second aspect. And finally, the whole operation was at such a cost that it showed that from a strategic point of view, Israel was not able to integrate whole accusation and allegation against the Israeli forces, such as massacre of population and all that. And that demonstrated that Israel is not able to do an operation, even in an environment a political environment where the accusation against him was so strong. And finally, it showed that those prisoners were well treated, even got some weight, so they were they had enough food and all that. They were treated with respect, as opposed of what the Israeli do with their Palestinian prisoners, who have deprived from food, deprived from medical services, who are retained against any rule of law. I mean, the application of law of war, in some kind of, some even mentioned the terminology of concentration camps. So the difference between the way the Palestinians treated their prisoners and the Israeli treated, in fact, showed exactly what confirmed, in fact, the picture we have from Israel. So Israel, in fact, never managed to regain the credibility, the respectability that a state should have when it claims to defend or to claim values and all that. So all that are failures, and everybody knows that Israel has failed on all these aspects. So the problem is that Netanyahu needs some kind of success, and he expects that since he cannot achieve success in Gaza Strip, he may achieve some kind of success in southern Lebanon. I don't know how things works in his head, because if he didn't manage to have any success in Gaza, it's very unlikely that he may have any kind of success in southern Lebanon. They were already, I mean, the Israeli forces were already defeated in 2006. And since then, the Hezbollah has gained more power. They were involved, or they assisted the Syrian government in fighting ISIS in Syria. Therefore, they gained battle experience. They gained some, not just experience, but they could also apply techniques, I mean, fighting techniques. They could improve their fighting skills and tactical skills and all that. We know that the Hezbollah has managed to have the capability in producing weapons and even modifying weapons that are available on the market, like anti-tank weapons and all that, in order to transform anti-tank weapons into some kind of guided missiles with terminal guidance, with TV cameras and all that. So we know that their military capabilities have been improved, their technical capabilities have improved, their tactical capabilities have improved, their regional support has improved. So I don't see exactly what the Israeli figure out if they imagine that they could have some kind of success against Hezbollah. We see that the Israeli defense forces have been strongly depleted by their action in Gaza. They lost credibility in the country itself. People, a lot of Israelis don't want to serve in the defense forces themselves. They quit and they leave Israel to avoid being conscripted or mobilized to participate in military operations. And therefore, we see that the Israeli forces are strongly weakened by these almost these more than 6 months fighting in almost 9 months fighting in Gaza. So how come would they have success against even a stronger force in southern Lebanon? Remember that in Gaza, one of the problem, an obvious problem of the Hamas is their logistics. And obviously being surrounded, by the sea on one side, Israel on the other side, and Egypt, which in essence is an ally of Israel. I don't know to which extent, but is officially an ally of Israel. So the logistics of the Hamas is very complicated and complex. Nevertheless, the Hamas managed to have new weapons and to engage new weapons in the Gaza Strip, meaning that they have ways to bypass all the checks and everything that prevents them to have a solid logistics. So they are able to do that in Gaza. Imagine now what could be the war in South Lebanon, where obviously Hezbollah has not all these restrictions regarding logistics. They have an open back in which they can import any kind of weapon. They can provide any kind of weapon. They don't have the problem of food. They don't have the problem of medical evacuation. They don't have the problem of having ammunition, new weapons to supply and repair weaponry and all that. So we see that fighting against the Hezbollah from the south seems to me a very, very hazardous enterprise by Israel. So I don't know exactly what is in their mind, if they imagine to have some kind of success. Maybe what they expect is that by attacking Hezbollah and suffering heavy losses in against the Hezbollah, that may prompt an intervention of the US. That's the only logical explanation of the eagerness of Israel and especially Netanyahu to attack South Lebanon in order to provoke an intervention of the US in the region, and therefore to alleviate a little bit the burden of this northern border, which is extremely vulnerable and has been attacked by the Hezbollah since the 8th of October, in fact, in support to the operation, the Palestinian operation in Hamas. So that's the only explanation to that the Israeli expect that the US would intervene. I don't know exactly what is the mindset of the US. Officially, they said they would not intervene, and probably that in a presidential election year, it would probably not be a good idea to start a new war, especially a war that would lead to some kind of defeat, and in support of a country which has already been, considered as a plausible genocidal state. So it's politically difficult to support Israel. It's military difficult to do, and from a domestic policy point of view in the United States, I don't see exactly what would be the benefit for Biden if they would engage into this kind of support to Israel. So there is a lot of unknowns. We have also to consider that beyond all the rational explanation I'm trying to put together in order to explain this or that and to assess this or that, there are an unknown factor, which is the emotional factor. Because when we talk about Israel, there is a lot of emotion involved on both sides, by the way. You have those who think that Israel should not exist and all that. It's very emotional on the enemy side, if you want. But there is a lot of emotion for those who support Israel, because there's a symbolic value of Israel. I mean, when we talk about Israel, there's always the World War II that comes to the surface. And Israel was kind of a response to what happened during World War II. And therefore, the symbolic dimension of Israel is something that drives all the emotions related to the support to it. And that's the reason why, despite the fact that a lot of individuals and people condemn the way Israel does its intervention in Gaza and the way it treats the Palestinian population, despite this, there's a lot of emotion that would, in fact, speak in favor of Western intervention in support of Israel against Hezbollah. So, therefore, it's very hard to assess what exactly could be the outcome of such an intervention. But I would say that in a first phase, without considering the possible intervention or support by Western countries, I mean, physical military support, Israel, in my view, should avoid intervening in the South Lebanon because it would be a military and strategic disaster for Israel. So that's my personal view on that.